25 years on, exploring the Chernobyl exclusion zone now, we speak to Carl Montgomery on 107 Edition about his ill-advised tour to the exclusion zone. Welcome to the programme. Tonight we're focusing on the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, and we're going to be speaking to somebody who has visited the Chernobyl exclusion zone. His name is Carl Montgomery. In his travels, he specialises in visiting ill-advised destinations, and they don't come much more ill-advised than the exclusion zone of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. Tonight, on the first broadcast of this programme, it is the 25th anniversary of when the disaster took place. The date was April the 26th in 1986. The accident happened late on a Friday night, and it was the early hours of Saturday morning when it actually happened. It was 1:23 in the morning. At the time, Ukraine, where the Chernobyl nuclear power plant is based, was actually part of the Soviet Union, or the USSR, as it was called at the time. Now, they were running a test on Reactor 4 at the power plant, which is located nearby to the cities of Chernobyl, and there was also a workers' town where workers of the plant lived that was located a few kilometres away. That's called Pripyat. Ever since the disaster, it has just become an abandoned town. Carl Montgomery visited Pripyat and he's filmed there, and it's all part of his video, and we're going to be talking to him in the coming minutes. But just a bit more background as to what we are talking about, the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. You're probably familiar with it, having heard a lot about it on the media, but just in case you're not, I could just fill you in with a bit more background. At 1:23 a.m. in the morning of April 26th, 1986, in the former Soviet Union, a test was run on Reactor 4 at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, which is located near to the cities of Chernobyl and the nearby workers' town of Pripyat, which is now effectively a ghost town. Two explosions occurred. It resulted in the wall of Reactor 4 exploding and releasing excessively lethal doses of radiation straight into the air. These not only heavily irradiated the immediate surrounding areas, which are now the Chernobyl exclusion zone, including parts of Ukraine and the very nearby Belarus, which is very, very close to the Chernobyl nuclear plant, it also spread, the radiation cloud also spread across parts of Europe. It was detected in Sweden, and Swedish authorities knew that a nuclear event had taken place. They knew that something highly unusual had taken place somewhere in the world. Really, after the Swedish authorities found out about the excessive radiation in the air, they found out about it from one of their own nuclear power plants, where at first they thought the excessive radiation was due to something that had gone wrong in one of their own plants. This led the very secretive USSR government at the time to really just have to admit that something had gone wrong, and this is what led the world to find out about what had happened at Chernobyl. It also affected part of the Lake District in the UK a few weeks later after the accident as well. Now, some workers in the plant made extensive efforts to cool down the reactor after the accident happened. It was extremely dangerous, so they were wading through radioactive waters. There's a programme on about this tonight on More 4, if you're listening to the first broadcast, which is April the 26th, 2011, 25 years after the Chernobyl disaster. It's often been said that if they hadn't done this, there could obviously have been more meltdowns. If that had happened, the exclusion zone could have been a lot larger. It could have protruded into parts of what is now Russia and even into the continent of Europe. So we really have to thank them for their personal sacrifice of really saving so much from what could have happened. Many workers weren't actually told that of the gravity of what had happened, and they were ordered to carry on working as normal around the reactor. Also, residents in the town of Pripyat were not informed straight away either. The accident happened very late on Friday night into the early hours of Saturday morning. The residents of Pripyat were not actually told about it at all the following day. So, with the extensive radiation in the air, they continued a normal Saturday, which is working, shopping, and hanging out, and doing all the things that they would normally do on a Saturday in Pripyat. And that Saturday was very much like one of the Saturdays that we've just had right now in the UK this week. Over the Easter weekend, it was a beautifully sunny, warm day, and that would have only led to even more of the residents just spending lots of time outside and enjoying themselves in the sunny weather. It was only really, I think, on the next day that the Soviet authorities, because at the time, the Chernobyl nuclear power plant was located in the Soviet Union, because that's what Ukraine was a part of at the time. They finally arranged at the end of that weekend for the residents of Pripyat to be evacuated. Buses were sent to Pripyat, and at the time, most residents just thought they probably would return, that it was just something that was a temporary measure. But in the event, they were just leaving for good, and they were never to return. And as a consequence, Pripyat has been left in suspended animation with all the things that resemble normal life. They've just been left as they are, including most people's personal possessions and everything to do with the running of a normal town. Now, when and if you do visit this area, you will see a ghost town where people have just upped and left with books, with school books and classroom materials left in the school, with medical things left in the hospital and products in the shops. And it's a town that's completely abandoned now. And I'll be speaking to Carl Montgomery, who filmed a video about this when he went on a tour of the Chernobyl exclusion zone in 2006. His video has been viewed 1.8 million times by people who are fascinated about this story about Chernobyl. The town of Chernobyl itself, which is what the nuclear power plant's obviously named after, is actually habitable today, but Pripyat is absolutely not. Carl Montgomery will be joining us a little bit later on in the programme, but before that, here is a radio version of his Chernobyl 2006 video, in which he visits the exclusion zone and explores areas close to the nuclear power plant and Pripyat, the ghost town. An interview with Carl Montgomery will be playing just after we have heard this. You can view the original video on YouTube, which you might very well want to do after listening to this. The pictures in the video are fascinating, and sadly on radio we just can't include them. As we open up into the video, Carl is with the government guide inside an abandoned apartment in the town of Pripyat. He is playing a piano which has obviously been abandoned there for 20 years. It is characteristically out of tune. And what the guide plays is a traditional Ukrainian folk tune. Next, we are taken back to an earlier point when Carl and the government guide from Ukraine, Yuri, are heading towards the Chernobyl exclusion zone. Naturally, they're doing it by car, but they haven't yet reached the government checkpoint, where they will have to show the necessary paperwork and get through the bureaucracy to be allowed into the 30-kilometre exclusion zone. Whilst he's in the car, Carl is certainly not short of questions to ask the government guide.
Are firefighters able to do anything, or did they...
I'm actually seeing the firefighters, first of all, done their job very well. In 2 minutes after the explosion, they were on the reactor at number 4 and started to localize the fire around. And they really rescued the world. Sure, all this crew now dead. Nobody survived. Well, these people were real heroes. Maybe they didn't understand what did they do. They just done their job Yeah. Nothing more, but in any case, there will be humans.
At this point, Carl and the guide have arrived at the checkpoint.
Australia.
They are given the go-ahead to continue driving into the exclusion zone. The Giga counter is pretty active.
What are we close to that's producing that?
Well, right now we are very close to the industrial site of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant.
Yeah.
To the right side from the road, you can see not finished cooling tower for reactor units number 5 and 6.
Ah, so they were it was going to be a much larger...
They were constructed in 1986.
Yeah.
Reactor unit number 5 was finished on 90%.
Yeah.
But after the explosion of the reactor unit number 4,
yeah,
it was made a decision to stop construction and never continue.
Yeah.
Because the international expert group decided such system of the reactors, RBMK type of reactor, is not safe.
Yeah.
In 500 meters, red building, many tower cranes around.
So
it's not finished reactor units number 5 and 6.
At this point, they are very close to the site of the plant itself. Carl and the guide get out of the car.
Maybe it's really a sad story, Chernobyl. If you translate Chernobyl into English, it's a black story. Maybe a black story continued.
Yeah.
Continues, because nuclear power plant was built there, accident here. Right now, all new enterprises had got a lot of problems again. Mm. Maybe it's a gem to us.
They look at the readings of their giga counters, which have been placed on the ground by the roadside.
It's 100. Overage, it's 100. Mm. Now, several steps.
The readings from the two quick places that they have set their giga counters down on vary between 3 and 18 times the recommended amount of radiation.
Now we put our decimeters here. There's several centimeters of the soil, no more. Was taken off from here. And you can see what is the difference here.
The guide explains how moving the giga counter just centimeters away can reveal different spots on the ground which have massively different amounts of radiation.
So that's just a few centimeters underground.
Yes, and
we
can understand how important all these centimeters of the soil is for protection of the irradiation.
Yeah.
Just several centimeters.
A few centimeters and
level of radiation in 4 times higher. This territory was cleaned up, well, just to look tidy. Yeah. It's a preparedness before the visit of the President of Ukraine. I don't know what the sense to do that. Just to increase in. It's a zone, exclusion zone. What the sense? It must be safe and not to look like tidy, I think, first of all.
As they continue to drive inside the exclusion zone, the guide explains what some of the local features are about. One site that greets them is a monument.
And a monument replaced from the Pripyat town, the black one there. It was on the center of the Pripyat town. In 1996, 10 year anniversary of the accident, it was replaced here like a memory about the abandoned city. Like former inhabitants of Pripyat town saying, the symbol of the town right now in front of the murder of the town.
Mm. As they continue to drive, the nuclear power plant itself looms nearer and nearer. As they draw up, Carl is 200 meters away from reactor 4, where the explosion occurred in 1986. Workers are, until this day, working to decommission the plant. A target date of 2065 has been set for the complete decommissioning of the plant, but until then, the site of the nuclear accident certainly won't be completely abandoned.
For example, here we measure it's 400 micron.
Yeah.
If we measure in front of the Western Wall, where all these metal frames will be 40,000 micron.
After a very close encounter with reactor 4, where Carl was just 200 meters away and 100 meters away at one point where he didn't film, the guide and Carl are ready to travel towards the abandoned workers' town of Pripyat. It lies about 4 kilometers away from the nuclear plant.
Is that the Russian word for Pripyat?
Radiation settles and collects on living things, such as trees and plants. As a result, Carl's giga counter is rather active along the road towards Pripyat, where at one point, trees line the road, collecting radiation.
And that's just from these young trees pulling it all up from the ground.
Yeah, but the root system now in the accumulations of the radiation waste, the dead tree.
The radiation level from this is 44 times what would be considered safe.
That's why you can see the level of radiation is pretty high, radiation on the road down 1,000 microrankins per hour, but to go to the depths it will be 4,000.
As they arrive in Pripyat, one of the first things that they see is the abandoned Ferris wheel and the fairground. Radiation at one point here is measured as 74 times what is deemed safe. What does that noise mean? Giga counters, especially ones bought from eBay, which Carl used on his trip, can only really measure so much radiation. The level experienced in this part of Pripyat exceeds what the little machine can take.
Oh, yeah. That's the point where my little machine says no more. What's soaking all that up? Where is that?
Yuri explains how radiation is sometimes trapped into the ground by features such as asphalt, because it simply cannot escape.
Because the moss here and the soil is accumulating these hot particles.
Yeah, yeah.
And no exit of the radioactivity to the soil for migration.
Because there's asphalt underneath.
Asphalt underneath, yeah. That's why
you can see it's too high.
Yeah.
My point of view, one of the tasks of our minister to warn population of Ukraine about the dangers.
Yeah.
To stop these people is very complicated.
Skated, yeah. Been...
But we must warn them that it could be dangerous.
Yes.
Dangerous.
The next stop around the abandoned town is the former concert hall.
Oh, here's the old concert hall. Yeah.
There are still large, imposing pictures of prominent figures from the USSR on the wall. At the time of the accident in 1986, Ukraine was still a part of the Soviet Union.
The Communist Party of the Soviet Union,
yeah.
Those times.
Yeah.
Then they step into a hospital which is truly dilapidated.
Where are we exactly?
This point was named Medical Sanitarial Point number 126. But actually it was the hospital and polyclinic for the people who worked in this place.
Are we in the maternity ward? Is that where we are?
Yeah.
In a former maternity ward, paint has peeled itself off the walls. The beds are almost reduced to their frames.
What time of the day did it happen? It was...
It was Saturday night. It was night from Friday till Saturday.
Oh, it was really early in the morning.
It was deep night. That's why people slept quiet and nobody... Very rare when people are saying that they've had the explosion there.
Next, they are inside an abandoned classroom. And as everything was simply abandoned, so were the school books.
I think it's the Book of Arts.
Oh, I see. There's the...
Yeah, the Arts. For first till third grades.
So it is.
How to draw.
Yeah, so it is.
Next.
Biology course.
I think yes. Supposed to be biology into ninth form.
Carl has a cigarette.
Yeah. Look at this, I'm smoking in school again.
Yeah, it's just strange.
Yeah. What's this?
As they venture into the school cafeteria, they discover that they can read a menu from the time of the accident.
So this is the menu from...
Yeah, from those times, Saturday, the day of the accident.
Yeah.
In the morning, children went to school like regular, and they had a cutlet of beef plus and porridge.
Then they spot a picture on the wall which has a close resemblance to a Disney character.
Actually seen in those times where I had lots of dwarfs, like heroes of the fairy tales, but we were not acquainted with Disney.
With Disney. That's a blatant rip-off. Walt Disney, if he knew about that, you'd have his lawyers down here.
And then we are outside some abandoned apartments. As Carl and the guide venture in, we are taken back to the start of the video, because therein lies the abandoned piano. What Yuri, the government guide, is playing is a Ukrainian folk lullaby called Sleep is Tiptoeing About, or at least that is the Ukrainian title translated into English. This is an audio version of the video Chernobyl 2006, produced by Channel 107. The original video can be viewed on YouTube on Carl Montgomery's YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/Carl Montgomery. The video has gone on to receive over 1.8 million views online. And now for more about the trip to the exclusion zone, I'm going to welcome Carl Montgomery to the programme. I'm welcoming Carl Montgomery to the programme Tonight we are focusing on your 2006 trip to the Chernobyl Exclusion Zone. Now, going by a website which is www.carlmontgomery.com, you are definitely more than a seasoned traveller, because you've taken in other destinations like Afghanistan, Somaliland and Sierra Leone. In 2006, you documented your travels to the Chernobyl Exclusion Zone in a YouTube video which has since gone on to enjoy more than 1.8 million views. So, explain a bit about your travel philosophy in life, which according to your website...
Good evening.
You have a travel philosophy, which according to your website reads, most people travel to forget about their petty little problems for a while, but you travel to be reminded that your problems are indeed petty and small. So, I mean, as soon as you adapt a travel philosophy such as that, you're kind of automatically obligated to explore challenging places. So, what drew you to actually visit the Chernobyl Exclusion Zone in 2006?
2006 came directly after a trip I took in 2005, where I pretty much formulated that philosophy you're talking about there. That was the year that I travelled through Zimbabwe. I don't know how much of the news you read on Zimbabwe, but at that time, as is now, it was a bit of a hellhole. And to cut a long story short there, I travelled through Zimbabwe, which was a bit of an entertaining experience all of itself. When coming back, I saw one of those famous Forbes lists that they like to make, and they had the top 10 dangerous countries for that year, and that year Zimbabwe was on it. And I'd agree Zimbabwe is a bit of a hellhole. It certainly was then, as is now, but I didn't think it was particularly dangerous. I thought it got a bit of a bad rap, to be honest. And so I made this particularly long list of places which had got a bad rap, and Chernobyl was one, and just set about exploring said places.
So, I mean, So what exactly is it that you had to do once you've made the decision to visit Chernobyl to actually arrange that? I mean, you can't just pop into the travel agents and go straight to the zone.
Well, funnily enough, in the years since I've been there, it is almost getting to that. You can't quite exactly rock up there. But at that point, back when I went in 2006, there was lots of bureaucracy involved, but there were agencies at that time, and as there are now, that you can contact, and they'll take care of the vast majority of the bureaucracy for you. It's then just a matter of stumbling through the bureaucracy to get into the country itself.
So I presume there was quite a lot of bureaucracy to actually get into the Chernobyl Exclusion Zone in 2006 still.
Yeah, at that point it wasn't quite the tourist destination. But it was still doable then, and it's doable now. There are a number of companies that they even run tourist buses in there now.
But what is it that you actually had to do then, once you'd made that decision?
Oh, at that point, it was a matter of just filling out loads of forms and proving who I am signing off on a bunch of stuff, which I really couldn't read, to be honest, seeing as it was all in Russian. But still, it was surprisingly simple.
And what sort of preparations did you make just personally with the equipment that you brought, such as the Geiger counter that we saw in the video?
Yeah, you see my Geiger counter in the video, which I bought off eBay. But besides that, I did also want to get a good idea, and not to mention I had a lot of family that worried about me. So I called up the only nuclear facility that we have here in Australia, and arrange for them to do a full body scan before and after, simply to make sure that I didn't actually come back glowing in the dark. You can actually see the results of that scan up on my website as well.
I mean, so that actually all went to plan, of course. So who was it that actually accompanied you when you actually finally got to Ukraine and into the zone that we saw in the video?
In the video you see a guy named Yuri Tatarichek. I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly. He's a government employee who works for, and I don't remember the name of the nuclear organisation in the Ukraine, but he works for them and takes a number of people and guides them through. He's basically signed, more than anything else, as a safety measure. There are
a good number of places that you just can't go around the zone, either because they're too radioactive or they're physically falling apart.
So was it really a set trip so that you actually got in the car with this guide and you really just had to do and follow what...
Wasn't it a set... No, it certainly wasn't a set trip. When I got there and met my guide, he simply asked me, okay, where would you like to go? And I pretty much followed it from there. I mean, he knows the area certainly a lot better than I do. But no, it's a set trip, really, when you've got your own assigned guide. You simply say, I'd like to see this, that and the other. There's certainly a lot more that I never showed on the video as well that I did see.
So, did you start the trip from Kiev and then have to make your way to the zone to actually meet a guide?
Yeah. Chernobyl is about 150 kilometres, so don't quote me on that. About maybe a bit over 100 kilometres north of Kiev. And yes, I had somebody who drove me up there, but then I met.
So when you actually met the guide, where did you actually go first within the zone?
Well, first you're a good 30 kilometres outside the zone, so your first stop is going through the first checkpoints. There's really two exclusion zones. There's 30 kilometres and 10 kilometres. So your first stop is to go through the first checkpoint, and from then onwards, what was the first stop. First stop was actually what you see early on in the video is a monument which was to the dead firefighters who were first on the scene when the reactor exploded.
And then from there, did you then go on to the actual or near to the actual reactor?
Yes, from there. You go through the 10-kilometer point and from there right on through, and you stand almost in front of the reactor itself, probably only a couple hundred metres from the reactor itself you can stand there for.
Now, many people will be wondering that there must be different levels of radiation in different parts of the excluded zone. So how did you actually know which parts were safe to be in?
Well, you've got a guide who will keep you out of anything that's particularly unsafe. But the more dangerous places, specifically right in front of the reactor, you can't go to. They're cordoned off with big, tall fences and people stopping you go through there. So you can't run into that much danger. It's certainly not the safest place in the world, but you can get away with it as well.
So it's kind of down to radiation patterns, really, that some parts are actually, it's sort of less
spread. The radiation levels do vary dramatically. Be surprised, standing even fairly close to the reactor, although it's very elevated, it's surprisingly low compared to even some places which are a kilometre away. There's one part in my video where the guy counter sitting on a little mossy part of ground where it starts going into its alarm mode because it got over the highest level that it'll allowably let you look at. That was a good couple of kilometres away from it. It's right near the famous Ferris wheel, which people see. I'm told during the disaster, the helicopters which they flew over the reactor, they did land there as well, dropping yet more contamination around that area.
So I mean, it can quite literally be highly variable as to where it just happened to land, and some parts even remarkably near the plant itself can actually have a lot lower a level of radiation than
a lot lower
than other.
Yeah, directly around the reactor as well, they've done a lot of cleanup work. They dug up the ground to a good couple of metres depth and replaced it with fresh soil. So even fairly close to the reactor can be relatively safe as compared to kilometres away.
So that's why you were able to stand there so close from reactor 4. Now, you were filming most of this trip, and we can see it in an edited video. Now, you say there was one part near the reactor where you were simply not allowed to film.
Yeah, there's I was going to say visitor center, but it is an information center which is right next to the reactor. As far as I can tell, they mainly take people there to raise money for the new sarcophagus, which they're still trying to build and have been for a good 10 years or so.
I mean, can you...
You can go in there and get very close.
What can you actually see from this point, if you were able to film?
It's fairly similar to in the video, but a lot closer. There's a very large window which is tinted to try and keep the radiation levels down. But you can stand... You're frighteningly close, this thing bearing on you at that point.
So, obviously, as part of the trip, you visited the abandoned town of Pripyat, which was built for the workers of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of the geography, just how far away is that from the actual nuclear plant itself?
The edge of town on the reactor side is probably no more than 1 or 2 kilometres. Probably about 2 kilometres away. It's frighteningly close when you think that exploded and went straight over the town.
And, of course, there was a whole day where residents in the town were not actually warned and had to live the normal Saturday after the explosion, and town life actually went on until the Sunday. So when you actually think of that, what sort of parts of Pripyat did you actually end up exploring?
A good number on my video. You'll see the schools and the town centre, the entertainment centre. The hospital. There's a number of other places I didn't include on the video, like the jail and a few other places, as well as various abandoned apartments, school libraries, playgrounds, things of that nature.
So did you have pretty much free rein about where you wanted to visit with the guide here as well?
Yeah, pretty much. I just said I'd like to see this and that. And when I had any time left over, he took me any places he thought were interesting.
I mean, in one part of the video, you actually explored an apartment and played a piano, which had been abandoned there, as everything is abandoned in Pripyat. And you actually played a tune. It was out of tune because the piano had just been left, which kind of shows you what happens if you leave a piano. It doesn't stay in tune. Is there a significance to what you actually chose to play that appeared on the video?
I didn't choose it at all, actually. We just came across this thing, and I asked him, you don't see this on the video, but I asked him if he knew how to play, and he said he remembered a few things. You see him first struggling to play it because some of the keys are missing, a lot of the strings are missing or broken. And one of the questions I get asked most is what he is actually playing on that, and it's something from his childhood, actually. It's an old Ukrainian lullaby. Which the name roughly translates as sleep is tiptoeing about, on a piano that's half broken and way out of tune. It sounds very different from its original. It doesn't quite sound as well meant to, and ends up sounding quite ominous, which I think probably set the video off. It was probably rather appropriate.
Well, I guess it certainly gives it a sort of haunted feeling, I guess.
Indeed.
Just by including that. So, how would you describe the having actually been to Pripyat? I mean, how large would you say that this town actually was compared to the sort of towns and cities that we're familiar with in Western lands?
Well, I mean, it's a regional centre. I'm sure in the UK you've got. Loads of large towns you'd probably even call them small towns of around the 50,000 mark. But if you were to imagine a town of that size suddenly disappear, or if you were to even try to explore every part of a town that size, it's not small. It's certainly a large city. And I only had a day or so to see it, but you could very well spend weeks exploring that.
There was a very famous, what has now been revealed as a hoax, Kid of Speed. And she She apparently takes a tour of Chernobyl on a motorbike, but actually you found that obviously you're not allowed to just wander freely in that way.
Yeah, a lot of the guides there, like Yuri, are a bit tired of hearing about her, at least in the sense of these people going, oh, you know, do you know about Kit of Speed? And of course, she did essentially the same thing I did, is go through the bureaucracy and organise a tour. And the only difference is she carried around a helmet to make it look like that she was going around on a motorbike.
Obviously, it's artistic license taken to an extreme.
Because
you actually...
Nonetheless, it did draw a lot of attention to it, admittedly.
So you filmed all this. Did you encounter any trouble or resistance to your filming attempts at any point, given that aspects of being in Ukraine might be quite strict?
Yeah, especially at that point. I mean, it's still a lot of hangovers from its communist bureaucracy. And officially, you're not meant to film there at all, but, you know, that's a bureaucracy that most people ignore. The only time I did run into trouble is at one of the checkpoints where I was just filming right there, and the guide sort of caught, you know, the guard there at one of the checkpoints, at the 10-kilometer checkpoint, caught me and did ask. Well, he didn't ask. He was very strictly said, why is he filming? At which point, Yuri turned around and turned that off and hide that now. Thank you very much. That's where the camera stops.
But of course, some of it actually did appear on the film just before that happened.
Just before I had to cut. Yeah, you can see the guard there looking at me very sternly.
So what possible plans might you have in future then for any more travels of this type to nuclear related places?
Oh, there's any number. There's one I've been trying for a number of years, but haven't been able to do as much. I haven't been able to do. Haven't been able to get past the bureaucracy yet. There's a town in Russia called Mayak, or it was the Mayak processing facility. Suggest you throw that one into Google and see what you find, or Google Concrete Lake. You'll find it as well.
Well, that's actually described as... I did take a look at that, and it's actually described as one of the most polluted places on the planet.
It's on the planet, yeah. If you were to say that Chernobyl was the world's worst nuclear disaster, you might very well call it the second, third, and fourth. Although maybe Fukushima overtakes them now, I don't know. I'd recommend looking that up. That was a uranium processing facility in Russia, which nobody knew about, which for a long time dumped radioactive waste directly into a lake, which they then dried up and blew its radioactive dust over a local town, then flooded and put more radiation downstream to villages downstream from there.
So does this actually have the same type of exclusion zone, perhaps smaller than the as the one in the Chernobyl area?
It's just plain harder to get into, being it's still officially classed as a closed city, Russia had them, and to get in and out of the city at all requires official permission, which I haven't been able to get to date.
Well, we'll have to look out for that, if there's possibly another video or blog about that, if you ever do manage to actually get through the bureaucracy and manage to visit that place as well. But I mean, the interest in Chernobyl has probably made it has made it easier for them to cash in on people's interests in this. And has made it easier to travel to in 2011. There are even large tours now. Okay, so for those that are not too... who probably heard about the Chernobyl nuclear power plant disaster, which more or less everybody has, but I'm not entirely sure roughly where it actually went on. And roughly whereabouts in Ukraine is the exclusion zone? So a Geiger counter seems... seems obvious, but what equipment and precautions would you actually recommend to anybody that is considering this trip?
Equipment, yeah, Geiger counter is a good thing to have. As from that, mostly it's just being sensible and cautious. You don't, of course, you know, pick things up and eat them, although there may be some tempting fruit around. You certainly don't go rolling anywhere, wear sturdy clothes and wash them there afterwards.
And what about picking up objects? I mean, you actually, you obviously, the guide made physical contact with the piano. I mean, there are various things which attract radiation and keep it, but what's the general rules on contact with things within the zone?
I personally wouldn't. Mainly is to clean yourself there, clean yourself afterwards. But I wouldn't be putting my hands in. I try to avoid putting my hands in soil or anything dirt like that. And that's where most of it is. Most of it's leached into the soil. Indoors, a lot of the areas have been cleaned up or at least dusted down in one way or another. You often find the indoor areas are almost close to normal levels a lot of places. And you see the places where I'm flicking through books or picking up objects are all indoor areas.
Now, a lot of people actually do still work in the zone. Did you actually meet or did you actually come into contact with anybody else who happened to be there during your trip into the zone?
Yeah, there are a good number of people who work in the zone. And most of them are doing either very scientific research or patch-up work. Around the reactor or the areas around it itself, various clean-up work. There's a good number of people who live there, at least for small areas, normally in Chernobyl town itself, which is a good 10 kilometres away. I'm told most of them will only work there for maybe a month or so at a time, and then they leave to other areas of the country to decontaminate.
So when you actually were in Pripyat, did you spot anybody else, or was it actually... Were you truly just in the company of yourself and the Ukrainian guide?
It was myself, although I'm told there is an old guy who lives in a village close by, and there are some villages a few kilometres away where there has been the odd returnee. I didn't meet them, but I have been told that they are there. They're generally old people who are close to death. Anyway, and have thought, well, this is where I was born and this is where I'm going to die, and damn the lot of you for telling me I can't. But there are a few people who live there.
I mean, that's what's interesting, actually. Of all the returnees to the exclusion zone, it's often been the older people who have the most sentimentality or history and who are more set in their ways, and they just want to be back there.
Indeed.
So you say on your website that you were checked out for your personal radiation levels when you got back to Australia. So how was that done?
That was a fun experience of itself. That they basically strip you down and put you into a tiny little lead box in darkness and stick you in a little dentist chair and lower this large Brobulator sort of thing. It's essentially a highly sensitive Geiger counter. And you're in the lead box to shield out anything, any background radiation from outside. That thing for about 10 minutes, and at the end of it, they can tell if there's anything radioactive in that box. They know it's coming from you. And that's because it's shielded so well.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you passed that test, but what if you hadn't? What would they actually be able to do?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not exactly sure. I'm guessing the... I honestly don't know. I'm guessing I would be carted off to a doctor and I don't know. I never considered it. And as soon as the test came back clear, I never thought about it again.
Of course, yeah. And of course, it was to pay off for taking all the right precautions and just doing it in the most sensible way that you absolutely could. Well, yeah. Okay, so we know it's on YouTube, the video that you made about it. So roughly, how did you shoot that video?
That was with a Sony Handycam, with a little wide-angle lens so I could hold it out and shoot myself as well as people around me.
Well, of course, because when you turn the camera on yourself, it kind of, your face gets filled, so you had to do that. And there's a HD version now as well you can watch. So for anybody that's listening that's now interested in watching this as a Zoom, everybody will be, where can they go to see this?
Or if you do a search on YouTube for Chernobyl, you'll probably find me on the list there somewhere. Do a search for either Chernobyl 2006 or Chernobyl HD, and you should find me there. My YouTube channel is just my name, Carl Montgomery, one word. Or if you look on my website, carlmontgomery.com, you'll find the video and pictures as well.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Carl Montgomery, who has travelled to the Chernobyl exclusion zone, amongst many other places that are ill-advised in the world, in 2006.
Thank you.